victories, would that actually stop the Yemenis from advancing?
I mean, just 4 days ago, the Saudis bombed Sana'a International Airport. So to answer your question, not really. And that's because all the facts on the ground demonstrate that the Saudis are not only losing territory, but also losing control over their own mercenaries. A week ago, the Saudis arrested 15 of their own mercenaries because they were accused, that is, the mercenaries, of cooperating with the Yemeni national resistance. And many defectors have accepted amnesty from the government in Sana'a. Also, the Yemeni resistance now has counter-leverage in terms of its missile capabilities, which I've alluded to before. Now the Yemeni resistance can deliver accurate cruise missiles, which you mentioned in your prelude to this. And these cruise missiles are capable of bypassing Saudi air defense systems. Mm-hmm. Not many countries in the world have cruise missiles. It's sophisticated technology. They cost around $1 million each. They fly really low and fast. They maneuver around hills. They can change direction.
And that's very important. That's so
Yemeni made. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ma'arib Governorate, Jay, is inhabited mainly by Islahi supporters, these people that you were talking about earlier, and they are the Muslim Brotherhood group that fought against Ansarullah in Sana'a when the war started in 2015. Now, do you think the fall of most of the strategically important areas of Ma'arib under the control of the Yemeni government led by Ansarullah forces, maybe who are on the verge also of securing very important areas like the Raghwan and the Midgal districts just northwest of the provincial capital, the last stronghold of Hadi's fighters and the pro-coalition forces there, do you think that this advancement might actually kick off maybe talks with the Islahis instead of starting new rounds of clashes?
Well, the Islahis are in complete disarray, and that's because back in 2017, the Saudis supported them against the UAE-backed southern separatists, but now the Islahis believe that the Saudis want them to cooperate with the Emiratis, which they're not too happy about. So in other words, for Saudi Arabia, appeasing the UAE is more important than appeasing the Islahis, who are now being driven out of Ma'arib as well. Many Islahi politicians work in Saudi Arabia, but many of them don't feel safe anymore. That's because last month, Saudi Arabia's Council of Senior Scholars issued a statement calling the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. After that happened, many Islahis fled to Turkey, which is an enemy of Saudi Arabia, including Abdul Majid al-Zindani, who is one of their top leaders. And frankly, who can blame them, especially after what happened to Jamal Khashoggi? So now it looks like the Islahis are being driven into the hands of the Yemeni national resistance. And there have been many defections. Take, for example, Sheikh Muhammad Ali al-Khuzayi. He was a prominent Islahi military leader. This is a guy who fought the Yemeni resistance in Ma'arib. Mm-hmm. But in July, he joined the resistance. Why? Because he now believes that the Houthis are defending the sovereignty and independence of Yemen. Up until now, the only reason the Islahis have refused to turn against the Saudis is because many of their leaders are in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. But once they all pack up and leave, we may expect them to join the Yemeni resistance, at the very least because they want to end up on the winning side.
Well, too bad that they took that long, but eventually it's good for all of Yemen for that to actually happen. I want to thank you very much, Jay Tharafel, member of the Yemen Solidarity Council, for joining us to talk about the new advancements of the Yemeni armed forces in taking and liberating the city of Ma'arib. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
القرآن للذكر فهل من path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 7 and 8 of Surah Jathiyah.
ويل لكل أفاك أثيم يسمع آيات الله تتلى عليه ثم يصر مستكبرا كأن لم يسمعها فبشره بعذاب أليم.
Woe to every sinful liar who hears the signs of Allah being recited to him, yet persists disdainfully as if he had not heard them, so inform him of a painful punishment. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we referred to the wonders of existence as undeniable signs of divine wisdom and the Almighty Creator's omniscience, which is not limited to the world of nature, such as the orderly functioning of the heavenly bodies that ensure the alternation of day and night, as well as the seasonal cycle of spring, autumn, winter, summer, and rains, but is also evident in our intricate physical system and the mysteries of the soul. Thus, the signs of guidance are everywhere around us, and those refusing to believe in these manifest signs suffer the consequences. In continuation, the ayahs that we recited to you now mean to say that those who mock the manifest signs of Allah and persist in disbelief and sins will be severely punished. The Arabic word waila, which in English means woe to, is used for sinful liars in Ayah 7 and recurs 27 times in the Noble Quran. It refers to intellectual traitors who make false claims and attribute them to God. It also denotes those who cheat in their business transactions, as well as ideological deviants such as disbelievers and polytheists, in addition to slanderers and backbiters. According to exegetes, wail is the name of a well in the lowest level of hell into which some of the most intransigent disbelievers will be thrown. Divine punishment is consistent with the offenses committed, and as is clear by Ayah 8, the one who hears the words of the Prophet but disdainfully ignores the divine revelation as if he has heard nothing will be afflicted by a severe torment. In other words, those who belittle the ayahs of the Noble Quran will be severely punished on the Day of Judgment. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the sinful liars are damned in the sight of God. Number two, the words of God Almighty should be communicated to all people, including those immersed in sins and disbelief, in order to awaken their conscience as well as to make it clear that on the Day of Resurrection they have no excuse at not being informed. And number three, arrogance is bad, but is worse when a disbeliever tries to mock God.
Thank you.
Now let us listen to ayahs 9, 10, and 11 of Surah Jathiyah.
وَإِذَا عَلِمَ مِنْ آيَاتِنَا شَيْئًا اتَّخَذَهَا هُزُوًا أُولَئِكَ لَهُمْ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ مِنْ وَرَائِهِمْ جَهَنَّمُ وَلَا يُغْنِي عَنْهُمْ مَا كَسَبُوا شَيْئًا وَلَا مَا اتَّخَذُوا مِنْ دُونِ اللَّهِ أَوْلِيَاءَ وَلَهُمْ عَذَابٌ عَظِيمٌ هذا هدى والذين كفروا بآيات ربهم لهم عذاب من رجز أليم.
Should he learn anything about our signs, he takes them in derision. For such there is a humiliating punishment. Ahead of them is hell, and what they have earned will not avail them in any way, nor what they have taken as guardians besides Allah, and there is a great punishment for them. This is the guidance. And as for those who defy the signs of their Lord, for them is a painful punishment due to defilement. Ayah 9 mentions another evil trait of the arrogant and begrudging disbelievers, who not only ignore the signs of God Almighty that are manifest all around us, but also react against them through slander and mockery. Thus, a humiliating torment is in store for such people, who include Abu Jahl, the arch enemy of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The next ayah says, hell is the destination of such persons whose property and wealth will not save them from divine wrath for their cardinal sins in worshipping idols and thinking that the deities their minds, warped minds, had created would save them from punishment on the day of resurrection. Ayah 11 means to say that the words of God Almighty communicated through the Prophet are guidance for mankind, especially for those heeding them and refraining from disbelief and sins. But for those who defy the divine signs, a terrible punishment awaits them for their filthy behavior. The word rejz, used at the end of this ayah, along with punishment, means defilement or filth, and may connotate that disbelievers will be punished by polluted and disgusting material. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, punishments are proportionate with the sins committed. Thus, who ridicule the divine message should await a humiliating punishment. Number two, disbelievers and oppressors rely on their wealth, power, and influential friends in this transient life of the mortal world. But on judgment day, none of this will save them from divine wrath, and neither will the deities and idols they worshipped would avail them. And number three, those turning a deaf ear to divine guidance and deriding the message of the prophets will face a disgusting and painful punishment, perhaps through polluted and filthy material. Now let us listen to ayahs 12 and 13 of this surah.
الله الذي سخر لكم البحر لتجري الفلك فيه بأمره ولتبتغوا من فضله ولعلكم تشكرون وسخر لكم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض جميعا منه إن في ذلك لآيات لقوم يتفكرون.
It is Allah who disposed the sea for your benefit, so that the ships may sail in it by His command, and that you may seek of His grace, and that you may give thanks. and he has disposed for your benefit whatever is in the heavens and whatever is on the earth. All is from him. There are indeed signs in that for a people who reflect. These ayahs recount God's favors to mankind and means to say that the seas and other natural phenomena such as the sun, the moon, the wind, the rainfall, forests, deserts, mountains, and underground sources function under divine orders, including the ships which we make to sail, so that God's grace is invoked and gratitude expressed to him. All wonders of creation indicate the power, wisdom, and oneness of God Almighty, who reminds us that whatever exists in the seas, the heavens, the earth, and the heavenly bodies have been made subservient for the sustenance and welfare of mankind. In other words, on perceiving the wonders of the world, the wise persons reflect upon these blessings and express gratitude to the one and only creator of the entire universe, so as to strengthen their faith and strive towards perfection. According to a saying of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, an hour spent on thinking is better than 60 years of devotions. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, God has made the entire universe subservient to mankind so that we use it in a proper manner and express gratitude to him through contemplation on these great bounties. Number two, Islam lays emphasis on efforts to earn provision for livelihood. And number three, positive meditation is more important than supplicatory acts of devotion. Now let us listen to Ayah 14 of Surah Jathiyah.
قل للذين آمنوا يغفروا للذين لا يرجون أيام الله ليجزي قوما بما كانوا يكسبون.
Say, O Prophet, to the faithful, to forgive those who do not expect Allah's days, that He may Himself requite a people for what they used to earn. Without the least doubt, faith requires magnanimity, forbearance, and forgiveness. Here, we are commanded to forgive or to leave to divine discretion those despaired of God's mercy and not expecting to be resurrected. Because of their distance from the fundamentals of faith and religious ethical principles, the disbelievers may suffer from undesirable conducts and attitudes. However, we ought to treat them magnanimously and generously, lest they may increase their animosity and further drift away from truth. Such magnanimity and generosity is intended to improve their conduct and may also make them embrace the true faith. Basically, strictness and persistence in retaliation are of no avail in dealing with the ignorant, but showing magnanimity may serve as a means of awakening and guidance. It should, however, be noted that this is not a general rule, since in several cases there remains no other alternative save retaliation and punishment. Another point to note is that all days are days of Allah. Nonetheless, the term Ayyamullah or days of Allah are applied to specific days as designation indicates their significance. The expression is attested twice in the Noble Quran, once in this ayah and another instance with a broader application in Surah Ibrahim. The days of Allah have been interpreted as the day of the rise of the Prophet's 12th and last infallible heir, Imam Mahdi, peace be upon him, to establish the global government of peace and justice, the day of death and the day of resurrection. According to a hadith, the days of Allah are the days of His bounties and those of His trials by afflictions. This indicates the significance of the last day, the day of divine manifest rule over anyone and anything, and the day of total administration of justice. To prevent wrongdoers from misusing such magnanimity and forgiveness, the ayah ends with the words, that God may requite the people for what they used to earn. This ayah teaches us that, number one, the manner of dealing with opponents differs according to conditions. Sometimes we have to confront them, while at other times leave them to their own fate. And number two, divine punishment or reward is in accordance with one's deeds.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the United Nations has said that Yemen is the most pressing humanitarian crisis in the world. This is the Saudi regime, along with its regional allies, and support from some Western countries continue to bombard the poorest country in the region. Yemeni blood is on the hands of many, but what will be done about it, and how can the suffering be stopped?
The humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been exacerbated by the incessant war and siege over the past 6 years. The executive director of the World Food Program, David Beasley, confirmed that the number of people facing the second highest level of food insecurity will increase from 3.6 million to 5 million in the first half of 2021.
There is indeed a humanitarian catastrophe, and if aid arrives, it goes to other places, and 70% of it goes to United Nations organizations to cover operational expenses. The other side must stop the blockade completely, because it affects Yemen in the medical, educational, and food sectors. So we think the focus should be on the root cause of the problem, which is the siege on Yemeni people.
Beasley called on the international community not to abandon the millions of families who are in severe need of aid. Millions of people are on the brink of a new famine as the UN's Yemen response faces historic shortfalls. $1.5 billion is what the donor governments contributed, while the UN says it needs $3.2 billion to avert the crisis.
Those who provide aid, such as the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and America, have failed and did not abide by their pledges they made. They spent more than these sums to buy weapons, but they do not help Yemenis as they claim, which confirms the authenticity of the United Nations reports that famine is on the rise in Yemen.
The coronavirus pandemic, along with the funding crunch, has forced dozens of aid agencies and organizations working in Yemen to scale back their assistance. Some of them even had to give up their programs entirely, which has deteriorated the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the UN. Famine can still be prevented if the international community wakes up to take serious action to save the lives of millions in Yemen, including women and the children. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Hossein Al-Bakhati, Yemeni activist and a political commentator out of Sana'a, and Eli Joseph James, a radio host and political commentator out of Chicago. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in Sana'a. Hossein, we've been hearing about the devastating effects of the Saudi onslaught on Yemen for years now, especially regarding children and starvation. Is the international community unable to stop this, or is it choosing not to address this, and why, if that's the case?
Of course, the international community, they can stop this aggression against Yemen and war and blockade and constant Saudi attack on Yemen main infrastructure by actually pinpointing who is the one responsible for this war on Yemen. We remember that in all UN statement or UN envoy to Yemen, either the British one or Mr. Griffith, they haven't actually mentioned Saudi Arabia as a part of this war, or United Arab Emirates, or all the countries that supported this war, like United States, France, and the UK. They call it as a civil war, and this actually they want to deceive and mislead the international media, and to deceive as well the international community, because when there are 17 countries involved in this war, they force blockade on Yemen. If you call it a civil war, this means that you actually not taking the responsibility from Saudi Arabia and other countries. And as well, we remember that United Nations actually has appointed Saudi as a member of the Human Rights Council in Geneva during the war in Yemen, and they have removed Saudi Arabia twice from a list for killing children, because as the UN Security General at that time, I believe was Ban Ki-moon, he said because of pressure from Saudi Arabia that they will cut all the aid to the United Nations if the United Nations will not take Saudi name. This means that for Saudi Arabia, this is a green light that they can continue the war against Yemen. They can continue the blockade. As you mentioned in your report, the World Food Program, they said 5 million people in the coming month will actually have food insecurity. There are 17 million, according to United Nations Agency and some NGOs, that 17 million Yemenis are in urgent need of aid. And with all that, with the coronavirus and the blockade, I believe, and it's clearly, as the United Nations have said before, is one of the worst humanitarian disaster in the world. But still, they are not saying who is behind this, because before we haven't had any of this illness or this food insecurity.
Well, let me cross over to Eli in Chicago. Now, for more than 3 years, Saudi Arabia has implemented that illegal blockade that our other guests have been talking about on Yemen, blocking roads, ports, and air traffic, making getting in basic necessities very difficult. So all of these things are man-made. Where's the outcry and where's the pressure on changing this reality in order to at least get the basic necessities to these individuals? Millions and millions of people are on the verge of starvation.
Well, there is none. There should be, worldwide, there should be an outcry, but all you get is a posturing, hand-wringing from the politicians of virtually every country except from those countries that are most affected. This is, to me, an exact repeat of what the Israelis have been doing to the Palestinian people for, since 1945 and even before, that the outcry is controlled by the mass media of the international corporations, which have no real interest in the suffering and the well-being of the affected peoples. But what they do are interested in is maintaining supply of arms, the supply of materials to the people that they do business with. And apparently the Yemen people are not sufficiently good customers for the international community for them to be concerned about. This is a humanitarian crisis that reeks to high heaven and also down to hell, because the United Nations could be doing something, but they're not. Now, my understanding is that this began in 2015 when a Saudi-led coalition began bombing Houthi rebels who had forced Yemen's president Hadi into exile. So as far as I'm concerned, this started out as a civil war, your other guests could correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the Saudis have no business getting involved in internal affairs of Yemen. That's my position on this.
Well, UN continually warns about the danger of the situation in Yemen. On the other hand, UN member countries, even some of those on the Security Council, continue to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, the regime mainly responsible for the onslaught on Yemen, with, of course, other regional countries. So Then what does it mean? Can the UN be counted on or cannot? And on the other hand, how can we expect these countries to help then improve the situation in Yemen?
I think the involvement of these countries like United Kingdom, France, and especially the United States is one of the main goal of the start of this war. We've seen that it's not all about bringing Hadi or as they call the legitimate government to Yemen. We've seen that what the United Arab Emirates is doing in south of Yemen. They have created militia and group. They have made ties with Al-Qaeda and ISIS to fight Sana'a or to fight Ansar al-Houthi, and those groups actually do not recognize Hadi government, and they have fought several times in the south, and that's one of the main goals of the war, to control and secure the shipping line in Bab el-Mandeb and in Socotra Island. And the other goal is to sell more weapons to Saudi Arabia. Those three Western countries actually are making billions of dollars in profit from this war. According to the Independent, they think about 1 year or 2 years ago, they said the United Kingdom has increased its sales of weapons to 500%. And as well, during Obama administration, the war started on Yemen with the green light from the United States. And they have sold the highest rate of weapons to Saudi Arabia in the history of the United States. That's why I think if this country actually still making profit, they are not going to stop this war. They will continue using the United Nations and the UN Security Council to only actually blame Sana'a.
Hossein, let me just jump in here. Yeah. So are you saying, for example, that the United States support for the Saudis in this onslaught against the Yemenis, it's all economic? Is it because of the billions of money that Washington gets and London gets from selling weapons? Is that the only reason that they are supporting the Saudis in this onslaught? Or tell me about what you think on that side of things.
Yes, this is one of the main reason, and the other reason is, as I mentioned, is to control and secure the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Is one of the most important shipping line in the world, and Socotra Island is situated in one important area south of Yemen, and to control ports and airports, especially in Aden and El Mahra. And this actually gives the United States and the Zionist state a foot or a presence in those area, because when the revolution in Yemen has took place in 21st of September 2014, the United States didn't like that, because here Houthi and as well the government here now in Sana'a are anti-United States foreign policy, and as well they are against the occupation of Palestine and against the Zionist state of Israel. All that actually is what has actually given the green light to Saudi Arabia to impose and to start this war. And I just want to add one thing. We've seen many times lately in the media that if Biden will come into power, maybe he will stop the war, because he has made many promises during his campaign. But I think this is a big lie, because the United States have the same policy. It doesn't matter who is in control of the White House, but at least actually Trump, he was honest with all his promise during his campaign. He has actually implemented those promise. But Biden, I'm sure that he will continue selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And the war started during Obama, who was given the Nobel Peace Prize during his administration. This actually shows the goal is economic goal to sell more weapons, and as well to secure and to control Yemen, because the strategic place where Yemen lies is actually given an interest for the United States and other countries.
Well, Eli, according to the UN, at least half of the country of Yemen is on the brink of starvation. As I said earlier, this due to man-made causes. Your take on this tragedy, and what can be done in order to change this around?
Well, the UN strategy is very much the same as Israeli strategy, because the Rothschild banking family created the United Nations and created the Israeli state shortly after creating the United Nations. So whatever happens in the Middle East is essentially the policy of the banking firm of Rothschild and Company, who essentially control all banking operations in the entire world, with the exception of some Muslim countries. They even control the economic operations of communist countries. So the overall strategy in the Middle East of the Rothschilds is to destabilize every single country within the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, including Iraq, Iran, what have you. Everything that the Israelis claim for themselves under their false claim that they are the people who have been donated by God, that whole area from the Tigris-Euphrates all the way to the river of Egypt. But that's false. They are not the people to whom God donated that territory to. That false claim is what created the Zionist state. So ever since they created the Zionist state, they have been using this tactic of pitting one Middle East country against the other. And in fact, Iran has become the new Nazis of the world. Once they got done with Nazi Germany, now they blame everything on Iran. That's why they don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. They don't want Iran to have anything. They want to destroy your country just like they destroyed Germany. And they're using constant chaos in the Middle East, pitting one Arab nation against another Arab nation, against your nation, against et cetera, et cetera. This is all that they're doing, and the United Nations is not going to end it because the United Nations are mere puppets of the Rothschilds. Over to you.
All right. Well, Hossein, the Yemeni people have fought back as best they could against the blockade on its country and the all-out war being waged against them by the Saudis and Emiratis. Now, this was a war that Riyadh said would be over in weeks, and now it has been more than 5 years. What happened? How could Riyadh miscalculate to this degree?
Actually, they miscalculated. They might have done this actually on purpose, because at the beginning of the war, they blamed Iran for, as they say, sending all these weapons to Sana'a forces. And after 3 weeks of blockade and constant bombardment, we've seen that the spokesperson of the coalition, the previous one, Mr. Al-Asiri, he said that they have destroyed 85% to 90% of the capacity of weapons that Sana'a forces has. But after that, it clearly was actually the opposite. And this actually proves that there is no weapons coming from Iran, because this blockade, who's responsible for not allowing for food and medicine to come to Yemen, all ships that arrive to Yemen are searched by the United Nations, are searched by Saudi Arabia, by the coalition, by American forces in the region. So how can Iran smuggle weapons? That's why the miscalculation started from that. But Saudi Arabia used this excuse just to get an attention from countries like United States and the United Kingdom and others, to get the full support, because they want the international community to believe that there is a real present for Iran in Yemen. But to be honest with you, there is no present. Yemen has a huge amount of weapons. They had about 600 ballistic missiles. They have developed new weapons like drones and cruise missiles. And according to the army spokesperson here in Sana'a, he said yesterday that Saudi Arabia are in the final stage of losing this war, and the Yemenis actually has not started to attack and target like airport in Najran and Jizan and Asir, south of Saudi Arabia, only because Saudi Arabia is keeping targeting Sana'a airport and other airport and keeping this blockade. And I just want to mention that I expect in the coming days or weeks that Saudi will continue to target Sana'a airport, because we have seen in their media in the last 72 hours that they claim that Sana'a airport is used as a weapons base for the Sana'a forces. And this is actually so silly, because you Sana'a forces will leave all the country, will leave all the mountains they have, all the hills, all this huge empty space to use the Sana'a International Airport. But because this airport is the last lifeline for Yemenis, and actually the exclusive client for this airport is the United Nations, but they haven't said anything when Saudi have targeted the airport on last Friday. That's why I believe Saudi now want to close this airport totally, even for the United Nations. But I believe if this will be done, then the Yemeni forces will take a huge step, and they will target Saudi Arabia main infrastructure, and they will target like a large airport either in Jeddah or in Abu Dhabi or Dubai or Riyadh, because they always say after any attack that if Saudi will stop and lift the blockade, we will stop. So the one responsible for the war to continue is Saudi Arabia and all the country behind it.
Well, Eli, what is the goal of Saudi Arabia now with this onslaught and blockade continuing? Does Riyadh just want to starve and torture the Yemeni nation to death?
It appears that way. But the reality is, here in the West, those of us who are savvy to the Zionist occupation of the entire Middle East and the Zionist occupation of virtually the entire world is that they need to make boogeymen, a boogeyman. So they've made a boogeyman of Yemen, and they have no consideration, concern. They have no humanitarian concern whatsoever for the people of Yemen. And as long as the people of Yemen are caught in the middle of this game where the nation of Saudi Arabia is being dangled by the Israeli puppeteer to do the bidding of the Israelis, because as your guest pointed out, they have all these strategic operations going on that the Israelis want. Number one, the Israelis want to destabilize the Middle East for their own purposes, and they create strife among different Muslim groups to fight amongst themselves. They created the Wahhabi sect. The Rothschilds actually created the Wahhabi sect. I don't know if your listeners are aware of that. And they have been using the Wahhabi sect, and Saudis were instrumental in supporting the Wahhabis against other Islamic religions.
Okay.
So this has been ongoing for, several hundred years. Several hundred years. Back to you.
Hossein, 1 minute. What is it going to take to bring this onslaught on Yemen to an end?
I think the only just that Saudi Arabia and United States and other countries back in Saudi Arabia, they only recognize the power and the one who is strong in this war. And I think if the Yemeni army will keep targeting Saudi main infrastructure, especially the oil field, this is where it actually hit and hurt Saudi Arabia, because they depend 100% on oil to buy all these weapons and as well to buy the United Nations and United States and all that. So if they do that, they can as well hurt the economy of the United States and UK and other country. And I believe if they continue this type of attack, if they can actually stop Saudi from exporting oil, I believe that this war gonna end. And we remember just about maybe 1 week ago, after the attack on Aramco in Jeddah, United Kingdom has sent some troops to Saudi Arabia, as they say, to protect the power and the oil field in Saudi Arabia. This means those targets actually gonna hurt those countries who selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And
okay,
this decision actually should be taken by Sana'a, and they have as well responsibility to do so.
All right, thank you so much, both of you, for being with us on this debate. Out of Sana'a, Hossein Al-Bakhati, Yemeni activist and political commentator. Out of Chicago, Eli Joseph James, radio host and political commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Sadly, the international community remains soundless to the outrageous assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist and researcher, even though the covert campaign to murder the Iranian nuclear scientist goes against international law. The silence of governments in the West is also questionable. It shows their calls on defending democracy and human rights or global fight against state terrorism are unwarranted. This will happen one way or another, but the United Nations and the international civil society are duty-bound to help Tehran bring the perpetrators to account. That's the best possible way for the world community to prove that the covert war against Iran by the United States, the Israeli regime, and Saudi Arabia has no international support, and that it must come to an end. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of First News Agency published under the heading, World Must Take a Clear Stance on Assassination of Iranian Scientists. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a top Iranian nuclear scientist and researcher, was assassinated near Tehran in an ambush on Friday, November 27, the sixth terror attack on the country's nuclear scientists the last 10 years. Fakhrizadeh's car was targeted by an explosion and machine gun fire in Damavand's Absard, some 40 kilometers to the east of the Iranian capital. In a message on Saturday, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urged all relevant authorities to probe the crime and ensure the definite punishment of those who perpetrated and ordered it, and to pursue and continue Fakhrizadeh's scientific and technical efforts in all the sectors. It is important to note that back in 2018, the Zionist regime sources had acknowledged that Mossad had tried to assassinate an Iranian nuclear scientist, but the operation failed. Several Iranian MPs have protested that Mossad had gained access to Fakhrizadeh's name via a UN list, which referred to him as a senior scientist of Iran's Defense Ministry's Physics Research Center. It is also important to note that Benjamin Netanyahu mentioned Fakhrizadeh's name while addressing the UN General Assembly in 2018 and said they should remember his name. While Tel Aviv has not officially acknowledged its role, the Israeli regime officials have hinted that they were behind the killings of previous scientists in Iran. U.S. officials have also preferred not to comment on the killing, which came after reports earlier this month that said President Trump had reviewed options to strike an Iranian nuclear site. At any rate, this doesn't change the fact that the scientist's family is suffering, and they, along with the entire nation, want justice, and they want justice to be served. This will happen one way or another, but the United Nations and the international civil society are duty-bound to help Tehran bring the perpetrators to account. That's the best possible way for the world community to prove that the covert war against Iran by the United States of America, the Zionist regime, and the Saudi Arabian regime has no international support and that it must come to an end. Notwithstanding the Western policy and as maintained by Ayatollah Khamenei, Iran will never relinquish its peaceful nuclear program, as with its many ingenious applications, the technology is a promising path to future security and prosperity. What this means is that amid assassinations and sanctions, Tehran will continue the development in nuclear technology and its numerous applications, especially in industry, hydrology, mining, agriculture, food, medicine, science, environment, and space exploration. The technology answers most of the present and future needs, and it is an absolute need that no nation can escape from. After 41 years, Iran is indeed a living example why the development in nuclear technology guarantees a much more stabilized and independent presence and position in international realm than counting on promises of technological aid by the U.S. and Western governments that never came under the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Obviously, the terror network of foreign intelligence agencies that, in a covert war, continues to target Iranian nuclear scientists, technicians, nuclear and military plants, and computer systems will never stop its criminal campaign either. These intelligence agencies and murderous governments are the key suspects in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh. The incident has removed any doubts whatsoever about their terror network designed to ratchet up pressure on Iran, blunt its nuclear program, slow down its technological progress, and distract its attention from reaching self-sufficiency in all scientific spheres through its own abilities and worth. No wonder Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, Major General Hossein Salami also underlined that assassination of Fakhrizadeh may not undermine Iranian resolve, and that revenge for the terror attack is already on the country's agenda. In his words, the enemies of the Iranian nation, especially the masterminds, perpetrators, and supporters of this crime, should know that such crimes will not undermine the resolve of the Iranians to continue this glorious and power-generating path, and harsh revenge and punishment is on the agenda for them. It's a sign that those responsible for the attack might be more than just one foreign intelligence agency or militant group opposed to the government in Tehran. While the Zionist regime has maintained its policy of ambiguity, Mossad is very likely involved in this joint venture with foreign intelligence agencies. It was meant to strike fear among nuclear scientists and workers that they risk their lives by working in the civilian program. Sadly, the international community remains soundless to this outrageous action, even though the covert campaign to murder the Iranian nuclear scientist goes against international law. The silence of governments in the West is questionable. It shows their calls on defending democracy and human rights or global fight against state terrorism are unwarranted. This application of double standards does more harm than good against the threat of global terrorism. Under international law and Charter of United Nations, however, there should be no double standards in fighting terrorism. The international community is expected to take a clear stance and work with Iran to fight terrorism in all shapes and forms. It is high time for the UN member states, particularly the Western countries, to condemn the Friday terrorism attack in Iran. It's the only way to prove that they also want to eliminate the roots of international terrorism and promote inter-civilization.